Welcome to another episode of The Gorghouls.
Oh my.
We're very excited about today's episode.
Sam has a crazy Charlie look right now, so.
Yeah, so.
This isn't even really red string theory because it's, like, you know, out there, but Sam's imagine she was sweaty as she was writing all this.
So, I stayed up late last night and this morning writing all of this down.
And you wonder about what? Current events? How to save the world? World hunger?
No. During quarantine, I've watched Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost 3. Because 2, I need to watch it. I haven't watched it. I've only watched it once. But, and, West of Memphis.
So good.
So,
and this is all because something's coming out on Oxygen.
Oh, yeah, that's why. So, I listen to a podcast called Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff. And season 5 of his podcast, like, he's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like, he has gotten people out of jail on wrongful convictions and all that kind of stuff. So, he uses his own money and his own time in this podcast to be able to try to figure out what happened in unsolved cases, or not so much unsolved, but
yeah, but just
wrongful convictions.
It's kind of like the Stephen Avery thing with that lady,
yeah,
which I worship her because she's such a
badass
bitch.
Yeah,
like she's like, these honkies won't even know what hit them.
Yeah,
and I'm like, I love you.
So he, season 5 of Truth and Justice was about the West Memphis 3, and he had to stop halfway through the season because they started to film a TV show for Oxygen. So this Saturday and Sunday, the 28th and 29th, there's 2 hours on Saturday and 2 hours on Sunday of the forgotten. He's calling it the forgotten West Memphis 3 because he likes to remind people that the West Memphis 3 are Damian, Jason, and Jesse.
Yeah.
But the forgotten West Memphis 3 are the three boys who died.
It is. It's so,
so
true.
And because he believes that Damian and Jason and Jesse are innocent of the crime, which they're out of jail, so, you know. But because he believes that they're innocent, he thinks it's a miscarriage of justice, obviously.
It is.
That there's nobody, technically there's people brought to justice for the murders, but the wrong people have been convicted of the murder. So there's somebody out there who murdered these 3 8-year-old boys.
Yeah.
So he thinks that's disgusting. So apparently they have some kind of new information and they've, you know, done their own investigation and stuff. So he's restarted season 5 now so far it's been an interview with Damian and an interview with Jason and then like a wrap up of the prior, what they've already talked about on the season to get you ready for the documentary that's coming out.
Yeah.
So that's on Oxygen at 8 o'clock on Saturday, and I believe 8 o'clock on Sunday as well, called The Forgotten West Memphis 3. For some reason, it's showing on my DVR as To Be Announced is the name.
Oh.
But if you scroll through and go to 8 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday, it'll be that TV show. So today, we're going to go through the West Memphis 3. I have the whole story written up for anybody who doesn't know, so we're going to go through that first. And then I have we're going to discuss all of the different holes in the case, and kind of like, you know,
yeah,
what we think and more information and like more opinions and stuff like that.
Yeah, because so, I've watched those 3 documentaries 3 times.
Yeah, I've watched the first one maybe 5 times, the third one, the first, like I said, the second one 1 time, and then the third one, I think I've watched it maybe 10 times.
Yeah,
like
they're just so good.
Yeah.
I always try and do like 1 sitting of it, because
And then West of Memphis is produced by Peter Jackson, who does The Lord of the Rings and Dead Alive.
Because he wanted
to
promote us remembering that all the focus was on these three, teens.
Yeah, and that they were
and the satanic panic.
They were trying to get them out of
craziness.
Jail. Craziness.
Crazy stuff.
West of Memphis. So, so we're gonna go ahead and start. You ready?
I'm so ready for this.
Okay, so this is for people who don't know. If you already know, and you can skip ahead to when we go through our theories and stuff like that. So on the evening of the 5th of May of 1993, Stevie Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers went missing. At around 7 p.m. that evening, John Mark Byers, who is Christopher Byers' stepdad, slash adopted father.
Yeah.
He called the police to report Chris missing, but didn't realize that there was 2 other kids with him.
Yes.
So there was a limited search that evening, that they called off after going maybe like an hour or two. So a more thorough investigation was started at 8 a.m. on the morning of May 6th. So they canvassed the West Memphis area, and they focused on the Robin Hood Hills because that's where the boys had used to play a lot. So around 1:45 p.m., Steve Jones, who was a probation officer at the time, I believe Damien's probation officer, they were walking through the creek in the Robin Hood Hills area, and he saw a black little boy's tennis shoe floating in the creek. So it was like on the littler tributary of the actual like main creek area, the drainage canal. So after walking, he walked through the water and trying to feel through the bottom and everything like that. So after walking through the water, he felt something got caught in his foot. So he thought that it was a tree branch or something like that, but it ended up being one of the bodies of the boys.
Yep.
So the other boys were also found in the creek, just a little further upstream. And their clothes were all found wrapped around sticks and shoved into the mud so that they wouldn't, to stop them from floating up to the surface of the water to, you know, and if the shoe hadn't been there, it may have taken more time than they had, really, because in water, obviously, a body decomposes faster, and we'll get into animal predation a little bit later, but literally, like, they had days until they started to decompose to the point where
it would have
they may not have ever gotten back up.
It would have taken, like, a lot of interviews with friends and parents to be like, where do they play?
Yeah.
For it to be like, well, I've seen them here, and I've seen them at the creek, and like, okay, well, we need to scrape the creek. Like,
yeah. So the boys, all three of them, had been hogtied with shoelaces from their right hand to their right foot, mm-hmm. and their left hand to their left foot. So not technically hogtied,
no,
but they were.
It's like a fetal position and then tied,
but it backwards.
Yeah.
They all had injuries, to their face and to their head, and blunt force trauma. But Christopher Byers was the worst with his lacerations, and he had mutilation of his genitals. So the official autopsy report says that they died from multiple injuries and drowning. Mm. So it was basically like they got knocked out, went in the water. So it was a combination of the blunt force trauma and the drowning.
Yeah.
So the police officers immediately went to the fact or thought that the murders had a satanic and occult undertone because of the fact that it was three little boys and they were hogtied and all that kind
of
stuff.
Some of the way that the scratches and cuts and like his genitalia looked to be like it could have been a ritual thing.
Yeah.
If you watched like a Satan movie in the 40s.
So they focused their investigation on Damien Echols, who was this quote unquote goth kid, and he was known around town for listening to heavy metal music and wearing black clothes. Damien had also had run-ins with the law before and had been in psychiatric facilities, but the reason that he had a criminal history is because he had a girlfriend who was Damien and his family were not well off, and his girlfriend was a little bit more well off for the area. So her parents did not want her seeing Damien. So the girlfriend and Damien decided that they were going to run away. So he was about 15 at the time. They ran away, he got arrested, and that's why he had a criminal background.
It's literally every 90s.
Well, and that's the thing is it's not technically, I guess it is criminal because he was able to be arrested for it.
I get it.
But at the end of the day, kids do stupid shit. 15-year-olds don't think about
stuff. If he had done
like
that in the 60s or the 70s, they would have been like, boy, I didn't tell you that. Like,
yeah.
I told you once, don't do it. Like,
exactly.
It wouldn't have been anything.
So when they started to focus their investigation on Damien, there was no actual evidence that Damien had anything to do with it. But unfortunately, they brought Damien in for questioning and for a polygraph, and the polygraph test indicated deception, so they used that as quote-unquote evidence against Damien. I mean, you're an 18-year-old kid, you're being harassed, literally harassed by the police every fucking day after school, and they're asking questions and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So polygraphs measure levels of stress. So if they're asking you about a murder, clearly they think you have something to do with it. So clearly you're going to be freaking the fuck out.
Well, and polygraphs don't even hold up in court anymore.
No. I believe back then they were inadmissible as well. But yeah. They were just used as like almost like a scare tactic to get somebody to be like, I did it, I did it.
Yeah, something.
So on June 3rd, the police brought in Jesse Miskelly. He was alone, and he had no parents and no lawyers present. His dad had given permission for the cops to talk to Jesse, but he had not given explicit permission for Jesse to be interrogated by the police alone. Yeah. So Jesse's interrogation lasted for 12 hours.
I know, and was he the youngest?
No, he was. Jason's the youngest.
Jason was the youngest.
Jason was 16, Jesse was 17, and Damian was 18 at the time.
Yeah.
So,
still, he's 17. Like, Jesus.
Jesse had, being, you know, a lower income person and stuff like that, he had had run-ins with the law and his friends and stuff because, you know, you get bored, you don't know what to do, it happens.
And it did seem like a town that knew each other pretty well.
So Jesse was terrified of the police, and he also had an IQ of 72, which put him in the borderline intellectual functioning category of the IQ chart, meaning that he's 17, but really you're interrogating technically a 10-year-old in the mind, you know, in his mind. So his confession, after 12 hours of poking and prodding and leading and all that kind of stuff, he eventually, quote-unquote, confessed to the crime and implicated both Damian and Jason Baldwin, who was Damian's best friend, in the crime. But there's so many inconsistencies, and Jesse was being led for everything. So they would, you know, just a couple of examples is the fact that Jesse would say, oh yeah, we were in Robin Hood Hills woods and killed those boys around noon. Well, noon, all of them were in school.
They were in school.
So the kids were in school, so they couldn't have been murdered.
And the cops would say, you mean like 2:30?
Yeah. Well, they would lead him to the point where he would be like, oh yeah, it was 7 o'clock. And then they would say like, so what did you do to his head?
Yeah.
And then it would be like,
hit him?
Well, I hit him. And they'd be like, no, didn't you do this with the knife?
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff. So Jesse just kind of, it's definitely like the Brendan Dassey case where Brendan Dassey is obviously intellectually, incapable as well. So he legitimately thought that the faster he confessed to this crime, the sooner he got
could
to
go home. Well, and I think Jesse just saw a way out where he was like, oh my God, this is making leeway.
Yeah.
So every time he answered a question, they were like, so what about this? He was like, oh my God, we're getting closer and closer after 12 hours.
Anything to make them happy.
Yeah.
Like he could see that whatever he was saying was making them happy.
Yeah, it was finally giving.
So he things such as the murders, the location, and the way the boys were murdered were wrong, but they kept leading him to the correct answers and used that as the confession. So soon, obviously this is a month after the murders. So soon after the confession, Damian Eccles and Jason Baldwin were both arrested at Damian's house and charged with murder. So was Jesse Miskelly. So then the trial came along, and Jesse did not want to testify against Damian and Jason. So his confession was only allowed to be used in his trial. They could not use it in Damian and Jason. Damian and Jason's trial. During their trial, everything against Jason and Damian were all circumstantial evidence. And the only thing they had against Jesse was this confession, which experts had said at the time was a coerced confession.
Oh, yeah.
So they, even that, it, like, the state obviously let it happen. They let it be part of it and everything like that. So Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly were both sentenced to life in prison plus 40 years, and Damian Eccles was sentenced to death for being the quote-unquote ringleader of the whole thing. So that's a very, very quick breakdown the case, but I have a lot more evidence, like I'm a cop. So we're going to get more now into the holes in the case.
Hole number one.
We're not there yet.
The case.
Yeah, exactly. So, bearing in mind, there's no evidence whatsoever against Jason and Damien, other than a couple of what we'll learn right now, witness testimony that didn't add up, but they used anyway as the literally the only things that sentenced these kids to life in prison and to death in Damien's case.
Basically, some old lady being like, "That boy's creepy. Put him in jail," and they were like, "Arrest him."
So also, it's not in my notes, but one thing that I learned today is one of the police, when they found the bodies and they were doing their investigation into the bodies, one of the people who knew about Damien, I can't remember if it was his probation officer who was out there looking, or if it, you know, because it was a small town, everybody in the law enforcement, like,
yeah,
it was like all hands on deck for law enforcement, meaning probation officers, cops, retired, whoever you were, you needed to be there. So one of them said, "Finally, Damien has gone too far." So they initially, immediately thought,
put a name in someone's head.
Exactly. So the first thing I have in the holes in the case is the lake knife. So one of the main pieces of evidence that was used against Jason and Damien at their trial was a hunting knife that had serrations, and it was found in the lake behind Jason's house. Frank Peretti, which was the medical examiner and the forensic pathologist, said that the serrations on the blade matched the lacerations that were found on the bodies of Stevie, Chris, and Michael. But the first thing that you should know about Frank Peretti is that he's not board certified to be a medical examiner.
Yeah.
You get in Arkansas, you get 5 times to take the test to become board certified. He took it twice, failed it twice, and decided for personal reasons not to pursue it. But the personal reason was that he already had a job as West Memphis's fucking forensic leading pathologist.
I know, they're really,
so hey, why would he bother to keep doing this test that he's failing? You know, I feel like in his mind it was worse to do it the 5 times and fail the 5 times than to do it the twice, fail twice, but then be like, oh, I could, you know, technically I can go back and do it again type.
Yeah,
thing.
He's got 3 more chances, and he was probably hoping that something like this would push him a little bit better in the course of being able to get it.
Yeah.
And also someone entrusted him, so he was just like big dick in town.
Yeah. So later investigations by Damien's team and by other people who, leading forensic pathologists, they concluded that the lacerations did not match the knife and they were due to turtle predation. They used to call it Turtle Alley, where the boys' bodies were found in the creek. Snapping turtles, alligator snapping turtles, regular turtles, all that kind of stuff. So turtles go for the soft tissue first, which includes the ears, the nose, the lips, the genitals, all that kind of stuff. Because it's soft, they can get their mouths on it, they can eat it, it's quick.
It's quick.
And then they go for the other stuff after that.
They're also young boys.
So the lacerations that Frank Peretti had said were from the knife, from the serrations on the knife, were more likely caused by the turtle scratching at the bodies to try to get up to the nose, to the face, to the blood.
Just scratching in general.
Including on pictures of the bodies, which you can Google if you want. They're kind of fucked up. But actually, within the first 2 seconds of... I haven't watched the first Paradise Lost in quite a while.
They show it
within,
right away.
Like, the first 2 seconds, it's the bodies.
It is. So just be... If you haven't seen that, but you are interested, they don't overuse it, but it is within, like, the first 15 minutes is when they show the boys' bodies the most.
Yeah.
So just, if you're sensitive to that stuff, or you have kids, or you don't want to see it, just be aware.
Yeah.
They really do. They do show it.
So that was what the serration, the leading forensic pathologist,
clear too when you see it.
The serrations were caused by scratching, and there was bite marks and all that kind of stuff from the turtles. So in an interview on the Truth and Justice podcast with Jason Baldwin in 2018, they had mentioned at the time of the knife being found that the knife had been thrown into the water a year previous to the murders.
Yeah.
So somebody tipped the cops off that there was a knife that had been thrown into the lake, but that it had been thrown in a year earlier.
Yeah.
So they knew that it had been thrown in a year earlier, and
whatever,
it was rusty and everything like that. So the fact that they thought it had anything to do with the murder, they were literally grasping at straws to get these kids.
And they probably found like 4 more knives.
So in the 2018 interview, Jason stated that he was out on the dock, or out in the backyard, whatever it is, fishing with his mom and his little brother, because he has two two brothers. He's the oldest, and there's one little one middle one. So he's out back fishing with his mom and his brothers, and his little brother was whining or something about Jason's pocket knife. Not the hunting knife, the pocket knife. So his mom got pissed off. Obviously, they fight all the time. They're brothers. It's all that kind of shit. So she takes the pocket knife and throws it into the water.
Yeah.
So Jason's like, what the fuck? My fucking knife. Why would you do that? Blah, blah, probably not fucking, but he's 15, but, or 16 at that time. So he grabs the hunting knife and says, well, if I can't have the pocket knife because he's going to whine about it, I might as well not have this one. So grabs the knife in the sheath, pretends to throw it in, but the knife comes out of the sheath and goes into the water.
Yeah.
So he's pissed off. He meant to do it as, like, a kind of a petulant child type thing where he's like, fine, then get rid of this.
And then it actually went the way it went.
Exactly. But it came out of the sheath that it was in and went into the water. So, clearly, that part, the knife, wasn't used. Like, not only, minus even the turtle predation and stuff in it not being the serrated blade, clearly, the knife, I believe that it was, you know, don't quote me on this, but I believe it was Dominie Tyr, who was Damien's girlfriend at the time, had mentioned to the cops about the knife in the sense of, like, have you ever seen them with a knife or a gun or this, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of questioning. She said, well, yeah, Jason used to have a hunting knife, but he threw that in the lake a year ago. So
gotcha, because,
that was how they came across the knife, and it was kind of like a light bulb moment where it was like, fuck yeah, let's go get this knife. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, we'll go get it.
Even though the turtle scratches only went so deep, and a knife probably goes deeper than that, but whatever.
So, that was one of the main points of the trial that got them convicted. So we talked about the witness testimony that got them in trouble. So, the next thing I have on the holes in the trial list is Vicki Hutchinson. So, Vicki lived in West Memphis, obviously. She had a son named Aaron. So she was coming into the police station on the day that the boys went missing to do a polygraph to prove that she hadn't stolen from her employer.
Okay.
Whether she had or hadn't, you know, they were going to use the polygraph. The employer had called the police and, you know, this was their way of figuring out whether she had stolen the money or if it was somebody else. So she took her son Aaron to the police station, sorry, I think that's my dog barking. So, she took her son with her to the police station. Aaron was a playmate of Christopher and Michael. I don't think he spent as much time with Stevie.
Yeah.
It was kind of like where you keep, like, separate different groups of friends. But he was their age, went to their school, same, you know, kind of playmates with them. So, bearing in mind this whole time that Vicki is there to see whether she's going to jail or not, basically.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she's stolen from her employer. So, I just got my exercise. I just hit my exercise goal. Apparently, let's get my heart rate up. So, at the time, the boys hadn't been found. They wouldn't be found till the next day.
Yeah.
But they knew, everybody knew that they were missing and everything like that. So, Aaron, while Don Bray was doing the polygraph, Aaron became such a distraction that they actually couldn't finish the polygraph.
Uh-huh.
Is their story. So, personally, I believe that they did the polygraph, it showed Vicki had stolen the money, and then when Aaron said what I'm going to tell you he said, it was like, we can use this. If you let us use this,
don't worry about
the polygraph, we'll pretend we couldn't do it. Because their literal excuse was that Aaron kept distracting her and couldn't do the polygraph.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind, they could have been like, go away in the waiting room.
Literally,
we
have police officers here that can take care of a kid for 30 minutes.
Exactly. Like, so, Don Bray, one of the police officers, talked to Aaron, and Aaron had told him that he thought that the boys had been murdered in the, quote, playhouse. So, and that he had witnessed it.
Mm-hmm.
So, at this point, nobody knows the kids are dead. They don't know where they're missing, they don't know where they are, but they don't know they're dead.
Yeah.
So, Aaron claimed that the murders had been committed by Satanists who spoke Spanish. He went on to elaborate more at they were these people in these men in the woods who wore like flannel with jeans and that kind of stuff. So he goes on to say that him and the boys, him and Michael and Chris, they have a, quote, playhouse in the woods in Robin Hood Hills next to the creek, and that they, after school, they always go there, and they always watch these men in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
He describes them as, like I said, flannel shirts, that kind of stuff. So he says there's a group of about four or five of them, and they always, he doesn't say it this way, he says it in a kid way, but they perform oral sex on each other, they have anal sex with each other, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, and he says that the boys spy on them, and that their playhouse is in the woods, and that there's boards there. It's not technically a playhouse, but there's, like, boards around.
It's like a treehouse thing that kids would make themselves.
Exactly.
They got a 2x4 from this dad.
Yeah.
A plank from this dad.
Got stuff out of the creek. Yeah. And this. So yeah. Aaron claims that him, Chris, and Michael spy on these men pretty frequently, but that the men are only there Monday through Thursday. They're never there on Fridays, and the boys don't usually go there on the weekends. So he tells the cops this, and then he says that he thinks that what happened is that Chris and Michael took Stevie to the playhouse without Aaron this time.
Okay.
Even though he had earlier said that he witnessed the murder, he now says that
he wasn't there.
Yeah, he just knows what happened. Yeah. Or thinks he knows what happened. Bearing in mind, this is before they were...
Yeah.
So he thinks that they took Stevie there because they had been talking about it at school, about how they see these men all the time and all that kind of stuff. So he believes that they took him there so that they could spy on the men and show Stevie what was going on, and that the men must have caught them and the men must have killed them. So he's one theory. It's not in my notes, but one theory that I've seen, and it's called the West Memphis Puzzle or something like that, .com or .blog or something like that. But he pieces together that what Aaron says the men are wearing when they do what they're doing in the woods.
Yeah.
Is what Terry is wearing Terry Hobbs, which is Stevie Branch's stepdad.
We'll get to it.
Yeah, that's on here. He's wearing it when Pam Hobbs freaks out, screams, and falls on the floor. What Terry is wearing is what Aaron is described as the men who are in the woods wearing. So
it's
anyway,
like literally that whole bumfuck town.
Yeah.
Like,
so unfortunately, because Aaron's statements were so inconsistent and wildly all over the place.
And also he's 7.
Yeah. It was obviously they couldn't use it. But anyway, so
but it's enough
his mom,
for them to
yeah. Well, and Aaron, they showed Aaron pictures, like a photo lineup, and included the pictures of Damien, Jason, and Jesse, and he didn't identify anybody in the photo lineup.
Yeah.
But back to his mom. So Vicky obviously is trying to get out of this charge that they're pretending they weren't able to give the polygraph, but we know that's bullshit. So the cops convince her to help them get some kind of evidence from Damien, some kind of confession or whatever.
Anything.
Yeah, literally any type of evidence that they can get. So she talks to Jesse Miskelly and asks him to get Damien to come to her house. So she does, and they set up recorders. The police set up recorders in her living room. Excuse me. She puts Wiccan books and Satanist books and stuff like that on the coffee table in order to kind of, like,
such an unbelievable friendship she has with the police group.
Like,
it's insane.
So they hide the microphones, and Jesse brings Damien over to her house. But on the 1st of June, 1993, so this is 2 days before they're arrested, before Jesse gives his confession.
Yeah.
So Vicky says that there's no incriminating statements made by Damien, but that on the tapes, but 2 weeks before the murders, even though she had to get Jesse to get Damien to come to her house.
Yeah.
She says that 2 weeks after the murders, she attended a Wiccan meeting with Damien and Jesse, where Damien had bragged about murdering the three boys and drinking their blood and all that kind of stuff. So but she couldn't remember who else was there, where it was, or any of that kind
Nothing.
Of information.
Nothing. Had
so
no clue where she went.
In 2003, Vicky gave an interview to the Arkansas Times, and she recanted her entire statement from 1993. She said that she had fabricated the story in order to get out of her accusations of theft, and that the police had suggested that if she didn't cooperate, they would take Aaron away from her. So yeah. not only would she go to jail because of the theft, threatened. She would be, yeah. Aaron would be taken away from her. So she also stated that the police, when they received the tapes that Vicky had gotten from the night that Damien came over to her house, she had listened to the tapes because it was like the clicky-click okay. recorders yeah, from yeah, back yeah. in the day.
90s.
So she had listened to the tapes, but there was no incriminating evidence on them. But she had just kind of, you know, where you make sure that the tapes are fine and
yeah, yeah.
recorded. So she, Vicky, said that the tapes were fine, but the police didn't use them as evidence because the police claim that it was inaudible. That there was nothing that they could hear correctly on the tapes to be able to be used.
Just like there was no test.
Exactly, because there was no evidence on it. So no. why bring it to court even though it should have been, because that shows that they've been looking at Damien forever.
It's just Damien being super confused as to why he's at their lady's
yeah,
house.
Exactly. So Vicky recanted her statement in, like I said, 2003. But one of her testimony was a huge, huge yeah. impact in the case. Along with another person we'll talk about a bit later.
Again, because the town doesn't understand Wicca or Satanism.
Yeah. One, you know, like...
They just want to hear the movie story.
Even putting something as stupid as, like, coffee table books to make it so that Damien's a little bit more comfortable. Like, nah, man. But, and then also the inconsistency of it being in June, a month after the murders, is she has to get Jesse to get Damien to come to her house.
Yeah.
But... 2 weeks before that, he had taken her to the secret meeting.
Yeah, I know. Like no, I don't know him well enough to works. Ask him to come over, but I know him well enough that I saw him drink blood.
Exactly, and he bragged about the murders right in front of
but
me.
But I also didn't come into the cops with that information.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is the DNA that was found at the crime scene and the lack thereof of the DNA that was found at the crime scene.
And I just want to say that all this should have been thrown out when Jason was at that wrestling match.
Jesse.
Yeah. Like,
we'll get into that.
I'm just saying. It has always made me so mad. Where a building of people saw someone.
And like, there's little literal photographs.
I know, and they're just like, and that was at 6? Oh, God, we already said the boys were killed at 6.
Yeah.
Fuck. Like, what do we do?
So DNA, the DNA collected from the crime scene was... not able to be tested, obviously, in 1993. They didn't have that type of thing. So
they didn't even have professional witnesses.
Yeah, the only thing they could do in 1993 was type any kind of blood or semen.
Yeah.
Like, so really, like, there wasn't much that they could do about it. So, but they... So in 2007, the DNA was finally... that was collected from the crime scene was finally tested, and it showed that it did not match any of the three convicted men that were in jail at that time for... murdering the boys. However, and this is a big ass fucking however, there was a hair that was in one of the knots of the boys that was consistent. I'm sorry, it was quote unquote not inconsistent with Terry Hobbs, who was Stevie Branch's stepfather.
Yep.
So, but the yes, you could say about secondary transfer and stuff. But the hair in the knot of the hog tie...
in the knot.
...was not in Stevie's knot.
Yeah.
It was in one of the other two boys' knots. So secondary transfer, you would expect maybe it to come off of Stevie, because he's in the house, he's friend, you know, like all that kind of stuff. But for it to be in the knot of one of the other boys would... That would mean that the secondary transfer meant that they touched Stevie, it touched the person, and then the person put it in the knot. Or, like, got it on their hands to get it in the knot type thing. So, yeah. So then there was also a single hair in the evidence that the DNA had David Jacoby, which is Terry Hobbs' friend.
Yeah.
And also Terry Hobbs' alibi, which we'll get to later.
Yeah.
But David Jacoby was the one who vouched for Terry the night that the boys went missing.
Yes.
So, obviously... an absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, but when there's not one piece of DNA evidence of the three convicted men, but there is in the literal hogtie knot of one of the other boys, not his sons,
yep.
How are you not looking, at least looking into it? Secondary transfer, blah, 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 whatever, whatever, that's fine, but you have to rule it out. Well, you can't just pretend like it didn't happen.
Well, but that's the thing, is there's three possibilities here. Transfer, whatever. You've got, it's in the knot. It had to have grabbed hair.
Yeah.
Third, it's Terry's rope.
Yeah. Just, well, their shoelaces.
Yeah.
So, technically, I guess, to be fair, it could be that they took all the shoelaces out of the boy's shoes and used Stevie's shoelaces to tie up one of the other boys, and that had Terry's hair on it.
You can explain it a thousand ways that way.
But if you can convict three men on completely circumstantial evidence with no trace of DNA of theirs at the scene, why are you not trying to rule out Terry? And the only thing that you say is that they were secondary transfer.
Yep.
So the next thing is obviously another Terry Hobbs thing. So Stevie had a pocket knife that, according to his mom, Pam, had been given to Stevie by Pam's father, so Stevie's grandfather, and it was just a small little pocket knife, and Stevie kept it with him
all the time.
He was always in his pocket. He thought it was the coolest thing ever
for like an 8-year-old. Yeah, he was probably
one of his only friends that had one. Yeah. You know, they went into the woods all the time, so he had it on him all the time. So it ended up that when they gave Pam back Stevie's things, the knife wasn't in the evidence stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the, whatever you call
the
it.
The bag of evidence.
Yeah, bag that they give, the personal effects that they give back to her.
There you go, yeah.
So, Pam said that she thought that the murderer had taken the knife.
Yeah.
Because she said that there was no way that when Stevie died, he did not have that knife on him.
Yeah, especially when it's not in his room or another pair of jeans. Yeah, like she said,
there's absolutely no fucking way that Stevie didn't have that knife on him when he died, and she just assumed that the murderer had taken it with them.
Yeah.
So, the knife, Stevie's pocket knife, ended up being found in Terry Hobbs' nightstand.
So weird.
And Pam had no clue that... Because Terry, his excuse was that an 8-year-old boy didn't need a pocket knife, so he had taken it away from Stevie.
Yeah.
But there was no conversation with Stevie's actual mom about taking it away, because she'd always let him have it, so it wasn't a big deal for her to let him have it. So that would have been some kind of conversation that they would have had, like, hey, just so you know, today I took Stevie's knife away.
Here, you can take it back.
Exactly. So give it back to him when you feel comfortable, or I'm going to keep it.
I just didn't feel he was playing with it properly. Exactly. I saw him doing something stupid.
There would be some kind of conversation. But that, like I said, the only thing Terry said was that an 8-year-old boy shouldn't have a pocket knife.
I also come from redneck background, and if a little kid has a pocket knife, it was probably given to them by someone very important to them.
Yeah.
You can't just assume that this kid went and bought a pocket knife. So, I know, at least in my family, if they took something like that away from me, they would be going back to a parent, because that thing could belong to
a grandfather, a grandmother,
someone very like important to me. Like somebody from the war,
something like that.
Like, I understand that this is a personal effect.
When it would have been something that he's, you know, cutting an apple, but he's cutting the apple towards his
hand. I don't like the way he's doing that. Or I saw him take it out when the other boys were around. I'm not happy about that.
Exactly.
Like, just something like
something,
that.
Something, you know, where it would be.
But as redneck to redneck, it's not just a pocket knife. It is probably valuable emotionally.
It is a conversation that would be had.
Yes. Especially in a tight-knit community.
And between a step-parent and an actual, like, and the biological parent, it would be like, hey, I disciplined Stevie earlier today because he was holding his knife wrong, or he was using it and he shouldn't have been doing it, whatever. I've kept it. It's in my nightstand just in case, you know, whenever the 2 weeks is up or whatever kind of, you know, thing. But Pam had not known that Terry had this knife, and she swore up and down that there's no way Stevie would not have had it on him when he died. So, also around the time of the murders, Pam's sister was at their house and saw Terry in Stevie's room in the middle of the night getting curtains, bed linens, and clothing to wash in the laundry.
Yeah.
Pam did the laundry. Terry didn't do the laundry.
Oh, yeah.
And it's literally the middle of the night. after Stevie's been murdered and he...
You're doing laundry.
And curtains.
Yeah, you're doing
curtains. Like, bed linens and curtains. Not to be, like, crass, but Stevie's not coming home. His bed linens don't need to be washed right then and there.
But curtains. Like, curtains are the weird thing. Exactly. Like, if you're... And you have to, like, also understand and visually see some of this stuff. He's not distraught when this information is portrayed to them.
No.
The mother, I don't know how she made it as long as she did. She loses her mind, as she should. But yeah. This is also a stepfather situation with a very young child. I don't have children. I know a few children that I'm not even around as much. I would lose it if something happened to them.
Yeah.
And I don't live with them on a daily basis, nor do I call myself a step-parent of some sort to them. He is holding his wife. There's nothing, though.
No.
There's nothing.
Well, and there's multiple video and pictures of Terry Hobbs in the classroom. In the courtroom.
Just
smiling, laughing, joking with John Mark Byers, who is Christopher Byers' dad. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of,
He's just fun. He's like, oh, man, stuff. I'm getting off work right now.
Yeah.
It's haunt, but I would understand her washing bed sheets and just being like, I have to have things ready for Stevie when he comes home. Curtains and Terry? Terry didn't give a shit.
Well, to mention that Pam had Stevie's Boy Scout uniform and still does to this day, and she hasn't washed it. So
then that would shows be the kind of thing, her train of thought.
Yeah, that would be the like, kind I'm of thing it where alone. It was like, Pam would be like, why are you washing his bed linens? I want to be able to come in here and smell
and go right
him
to
and,
bed.
Exactly.
Like, when he comes home, he's going to go right to bed. Yeah. Like,
so, yeah. So the next thing is that there was a huge, huge amount of jury misconduct during the trial.
Yeah.
So the foreman of the jury for the Eccles and Baldwin trial was Kent Arnold. And he had discussed, when he was summoned for jury duty, he had discussed with a lawyer prior to the start of the trial about how to get on the jury.
Yes.
He wanted to be on this jury, but he had also discussed with this lawyer that he believed that the two boys were, with the three boys, but he was only in the trial for the two boys, were guilty of this murder, and he wanted to make sure he was on the jury so he could sway any other jury members who might not believe it. He wanted to be able to sway them to be on his side and get them convicted of being guilty.
The exact of what they don't want.
So, a witness stated that he wanted somebody to coach him of what to say when they asked, because they always ask the questions of, like, do you think they did it? Do you know anything about this? Blah, blah, blah. All of those kind of specific questions to see if you're already biased. So he was coached to be able to be on the jury and pretend to be completely non-biased before the jury, or before the trial, I'm sorry. So Kent Arnold knew about Jesse's confession because it had been leaked to the media.
Yeah.
So it had been in the newspaper.
It was all over the place. There was so many people that knew.
He knew about Jesse's confession, but he also knew that it was not allowed to be used in the Baldwin and Eccles trial. So he had said to somebody, when are we going to hear about the confession? And they had said, well, that's not part of this trial, so you can't use that. That's not, you know. And then, so obviously, that should have sent up a red flag for whoever that was, that he should be recused from being on the jury.
Yeah.
But he wasn't. So during the deliberations of the jury, he told the jury about the confession.
Yeah.
He told them all, you know, everything that Jesse had said, everything that wasn't supposed to be known in that trial. They were only supposed to go on what the evidence they had gotten in that courtroom, obviously. Yep. And he basically got everybody to vote guilty.
Yeah.
Because he brought in the confession. And there was a piece of paper from the deliberation room that had a list of all the different things on it, of what they had done and all that kind of stuff. And the confession was on there. It was scratched out with a pen.
Yeah.
But it was still on the list. Kent Arnold had introduced that into the jury deliberation.
Yeah.
So that should have been, it should have resulted in a mistrial, so that they either got a different second fair trial or, you know, a mistrial they could technically just
throw the whole thing
out. Yeah, exactly. So now we're going to get to arguably the most conspiracy theory type thing I have. So, Mr. Bojangles.
Bring out the red string.
So, on the night of May 5th, the boys were still missing. They weren't found till the next day. A call came into the police station from the Bojangles restaurant that saying that an African-American male had entered the restaurant and he was covered in blood and mud, and he was seemingly very confused, didn't know where he was, kind of out of it, you know, just completely confused. So he went into the women's bathroom and he got blood that was covering him and feces all over the walls of the women's bathroom.
Yeah.
The restaurateur, like the manager and stuff, tried to get him to leave. He wouldn't leave, so they had called the police. So the call came in at about 8:42, and the Bojangles was less than a mile from where the boys were found.
Yeah.
A very, very, very easy distance. If they're murdered at 6:30 to 7, and he gets there at 8:42, that's more than enough time to have killed the boys, done all the stuff that he needed to do, and then get to the Bojangles. So, the man left before the police arrived, but when the police got there, there was blood and feces all over the wall, so they took scrapings of the blood as samples, because at that point they didn't know the boys were still missing, but they took the blood samples because the guy's covered in blood. Take blood samples.
Whose blood is it, or do we trace it back to him?
So the blood samples were lost by the police officer. Lost or...
Such an easy mistake.
You know, something like that. You know, misplaced.
Yes.
By the police officer who had taken the scrapings of the blood. So somewhere between Bojangles and the police station, it had just gone missing.
Missed, yep.
And by the time... They, obviously, it's a restaurant, so they had to clean up the bathroom and stuff, so all the blood's gone. So at the crime scene, there was a hair that belonged to someone of African descent, but because the blood samples from Bojangles were missing or lost, there was nothing to test the DNA of the African-American hair to the blood of the man at Bojangles.
Yeah.
And he was never seen, never found, and never identified by anybody.
Crazy.
He just literally just fucking disappeared.
Yeah.
So, I don't...
What drug trip was he on?
Yeah, I don't know. He had, according to the people at the Bojangles restaurant, he had, when they say he was covered in mud, the blood was all over on his arms and stuff, because the blood that was on the walls in the women's bathroom were from his arms, like, flailing around.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
But the mud was a little bit on him.
Well, yeah,
but
of course.
It was like he had been wading through muddy water. It was up to his knees or calves or whatever
it's
it
just,
was.
It's up his pant legs and his feet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was where the mud came from. So, clearly... Yes, maybe he wasn't involved, because obviously there are other options, but A, he could have been part of the group of men that Aaron Hutchison had said was in the woods.
Yes.
You know, he could have been from the blue, because the wood, it goes, there's an apartment complex and housing, then there's a sliver of forest, then the creek, then another sliver of forest, and then the Blue Beacon Car Wash, so which is like a truck stop. So he could have been, the fact that he was never found suggests to me personally that he could have been a trucker coming through Arkansas.
Yeah.
You know, say, because I have my own theories of who it is. So I think that what happened is he was a trucker that came through, stopped at the Blue Beacon, whatever. You know, we always, when you see these, documentaries, not West of Memphis, but the Three Paradise Lost, you think that this creek is in the middle of this massive wood, and
it's
not.
No.
It's like maybe a quarter mile across from Wood Creek, Wood, and then the Blue Beacon Car.
Yeah, it's really, it just depends on how you point a camera. It can look like thousands
of acres.
Well,
and they flattened it now,
and
now that they flattened it, you can see that it's like literally...
It's right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, my hypothesis is that this guy was a trucker, he... went into the woods to piss or to, you know, have a smoke or, you know, whatever
do
it was.
Something.
He saw what had happened and then tried to help the boys and then freaked out. Obviously had some kind of mental breakdown because he just saw these three little boys being murdered and then went to found himself at the Bojangles to try and clean up. But because he was confused and he left and he freaked out because you know, obviously the climate in 1993, probably not even better than today, as an African-American man...
It's going to go straight on to him.
Exactly. Trying to explain that, no, I saw another man do it, they're not going to listen. They're just, you're an out-of-town trucker driving through West Memphis. Nobody's going to fucking believe you. So that's my hypothesis. It could be completely off base, but that's what I think about Mr. Bojangles, is that he might have tried to help, and that's why he was covered in the blood and stuff.
It, that would make sense. I kind of wonder, because it is a good place to pick up someone like that. You know, you want to make something on the side.
Yeah.
You need a little something. I got stuff. Follow me out here. And he said, I could definitely go for some crack.
Yeah.
Maybe some coke.
Yeah.
I have to sit here. Truckers.
Speed.
Anything.
He's trying to make, he's trying to make his, you know, delivery on time, and you know, he needs to be awake through the night, so he takes some speed.
He could do that. He could be getting ready to,
which is meth,
go to sleep for a little bit. Someone approaches him. I just need you to do something for me. Probably thinks that he's going to ask for, like, a blowjob or something.
Yeah.
So they go into the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sees this scene. And snaps. In the sense of, like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah. Well, complete
trying
trauma
to save the kids. Trying
over.
To do this.
Yeah.
Maybe fighting this other person off.
Yeah, because they, you know, believe that the blood from his arms was his blood.
Pushing.
Yeah.
Punching.
From, like, scratches in the
woods. Anything
that
he's doing.
Like that.
And then, like you said, complete shock, daze, wander.
Yeah.
He doesn't know who he just watched.
Yeah.
He doesn't know
anybody.
The three boys.
Yeah. He doesn't know where he is,
he
really.
Barely just, he knows the state he's in.
Yeah. He walked through the woods and walked to the Bojangles.
And like, now, also, what am I going to tell someone, that I was looking to get my dick sucked for some crack?
Yeah.
Like, he's in such a just image that he probably wandered in the first building he saw. Now you got people doing stuff and around, and he's like, I just, it,
yeah,
ugh, you know.
So in the documentaries, it is also mentioned that we talked about Damien's criminal history, and that technically, yes, it is, but really, come on.
It's kind of a bad teen in the 90s history.
Yeah.
Like,
so they also talk about the fact that Jason is also on probation and that he has a criminal history, but they never really elaborate. So on the Truth and Justice podcast, Jason, in an interview, he told Bob Ruff what the criminal history was. So what they had made such a big deal about, that these two boys had criminal history, is that Jason, with his two younger brothers and some other neighborhood kids, there was an old house or old building, some kind of, you know,
the one house
whatever.
In town that's always abandoned.
Yeah, abandoned building. So it had a tree that had grown, and it made it so that you could climb up one edge, one side of the tree, and go down the other and be inside the building. So him and all these other kids, including his two younger brothers, had gone in the building to play hide and seek. So somebody, a neighbor, whatever, had called the police, and they all got arrested.
Gotcha.
So Jason...
Trespassing.
Yeah. So Jason, his public defender and his brother's public defender had told him, you haven't got anything to worry about, don't worry about it, we'll be fine, everything will be fine. So when they go to court, the judge suggests that the boys, all the kids, are sent to a juvenile detention school. I don't really know what that means. I think that it's that they stay there, but I could be wrong, and it could be just like a day thing, like a military school type thing.
Yeah.
It's unclear to me what it was.
It probably also depends state to state.
Yeah. So Jason's public defender stands up and says, excellent, let's do that. After telling Jason that everything's going to be fine.
Yeah.
So Jason's mom is obviously in the courtroom too, and gets up and says, no, that's unacceptable. They were playing hide and seek. This is absolutely ridiculous. So the judge says, okay, what's going to happen then is all of the kids, including Jason and his two brothers, are going to get 5 years probation, and each individual kid has to pay a $500 fine.
Gotcha.
So
that's $1,500 for her.
During the interview, Jason says that at the time, they were obviously, like, very poor. At the time, the Christmas budget for the entire household, him and his two brothers included, was $100 for the whole household.
Jesus
so he
Christ.
Said, this ended up being 15 Christmases worth of money.
Yeah.
Like, so his mom had to deal with that, and he had 5 years of probation. So when they say that he had a criminal record and they try to play that up, it's because he played hide and seek with his friends. Like a big group of, yeah, a big group of kids. Like, it's just absolutely ridiculous to me. And that they make such a big deal about.
Well, it's so easy to say, oh, he's got a criminal record. And it's like, trespass, like, literally.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you're playing fucking hide and seek. Who hasn't played hide and seek in an abandoned building? Like, it's just what you do as a kid.
It's just
like,
really easy to make it sound so much worse by saying criminal history.
Yeah, well, and at the time, they were 8, 10, and 12. So it's not like they were, like, there's malicious. No intent there. Yeah, no, they weren't going there to smoke, they weren't going there to do drugs or have sex, or they were fucking kids, they were playing hide and seek. It might be
someone's house, but it's not someone's, like, living house. No, like, obviously,
it's just an abandoned building. So another thing that I think is disgusting is they had Dale Griffiths, which is a quote-unquote occult expert witness. The prosecution brought him in to talk about Damien and how these murders related to being an occult murder.
And however you think this guy looks, it's not.
So he has a PhD in occult and he's the expert witness for the state. This motherfucker, his PhD is from a mail-in college. He did not take one class. He did not do anything to obtain. You send in what PhD you want, you pay the money, and you send it back. So that was their expert witness on the occult. So then we get to, obviously.
And his thing is great. And when he's like, ridiculous. Satanist love. Like, he literally, it's like he watched, like, The Brides of Satan from, like, the 50s. And he was like, okay, I got it. They like wearing robes. They like black makeup. They like...
His testimony was ridiculous.
It's, like, so... It's really... Even if you just, like, fast forward to that part, it's really, really phenomenal. Yeah. Like...
So, the last thing we're talking about before we get to, like, you know, just spitballing is the way the men were able to get out of prison. So Jason, Jesse, and Damien, it was Jason and Jesse, I don't want to say they were fine, they were obviously in prison, but Damien was in jeopardy of being murdered.
Yeah, he had death row.
Like, he was, you know, he had been on death row for 18 years, yep. So it was getting to the point where this was his last appeal, and if he didn't, he was going to get the lethal injection and be done. So they took what is called an Alford plea.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that while the three men maintain their innocence and that they did not commit the crime, they acknowledge that the state has enough evidence that they can convict them. Which means that they get a suspended sentence, time served, and they get out of prison. Jason did not want to take it. But he knew that he had to.
For the other two.
Because otherwise Damien would be dead.
Yeah.
So Jesse was obviously, he didn't care. He wanted to just get out of prison, which but Jason is so, like, he's so, like, I don't even know how to describe it. He's so
committed.
He knows he's innocent and he does not want to admit, even to get out of prison.
It's like letting the state win. He would rather sit in jail until his heart takes that final beat.
Exactly.
So that the state doesn't win.
Exactly. And an Alford plea also means that because they're not technically wrongfully convicted, they can't sue the state.
Yeah.
So
it's just the state and them shaking hands, basically.
Yeah,
and
to be like, all right, let's get out of here.
So, it also saves the state from having to find anything else about the case.
Yeah. Well, and that means that they have the convicted men. They don't have to go out and look for anybody else.
It's shut.
They acknowledge it's all done. You know, it's there. They have who it was. They've served their time, and that's that. But they maintain their innocence, it's that they maintain their innocence, but they acknowledge that the state is able
to say that,
to
they're
say that
guilty.
They were guilty.
Yeah. Saves the state's ass from having to go and do their job.
Yeah.
And putting three boys to actual rest.
Yeah. Well, and the thing I think that the reason why this case is such a big deal for me is that, A, we were those goth kids. We were the kids that in a small town in Arkansas definitely could... you know, I have Wiccan books. I have, you know, we wear black clothes. We were always goth kids. Like, we love Halloween. All, you know, I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you can definitely...
relate.
Yeah. Relate to the, you know, Damien especially.
It's Damien mostly. The other two are...
Oh, another thing that I didn't mention was that they kept... It's the same vein as... It's the same vein as with Jason's criminal history. So in the same vein as them blowing up Damien and Jason's criminal history, is one thing that they were very adamant about was that Jason, Damien, and Jesse were best friends, which is not the case.
No.
Jason, in the same interview as he had told us about the why he had probation... He says that the first day that he ever met Jesse Miskelly, Jesse tried to beat him up. They were not friends. And Jesse's dad, in West of Memphis, mentions that, A, Jesse was extremely scared of Damien, and that they did not hang out. They were not friends.
Yeah.
So, they lumped these three kids together, but they weren't friends.
Yeah.
Like, that's, it's not, they weren't. Like, so that was another misconception from... A lot of people, is I thought for a longer time that the three of them were really good friends.
But even when you listen to the first documentary, each of them explain a totally different life. Like, we could be interviewed separately, and they'd be like, these two girls should meet.
Yeah.
Damien's like, no, I like to be inside, I read, I write, I blah.
Yeah.
Jesse's like, oh yeah, I shoot, I hunt, I go mudding,
yeah,
I do redneck stuff.
Yeah.
And then Jason's like... Meathead.
Yeah.
Like, I wrestle, I football, I...
Yeah, Jesse was the wrestler.
Jesse. It just... And I'm not saying... I mean, I had friends from all kinds of different walks.
Yeah.
But you interview these three separate kids, and you're like, there's not even a time you three would meet up.
No, they weren't friends. They went to the same school, but they were not friends.
Yeah.
So another thing that got...
That explains a lot of our relationships.
Right. The other thing that, the other witness that I talked about when I was talking about Vicki Hutchison was Michael Carson, and he testified that he had heard that Jason Baldwin bragging about committing the murder and doing all different kinds of occult stuff to the bodies after they were murdered while they were in jail together. Later, he admitted, while that was another nail in the coffin for Jason... Michael Carson later said that, A, he was completely on drugs. He was on LSD. Yep. He was on inhalants.
I don't know what the hell I said.
Yeah. So they had offered him, obviously,
exactly.
another thing, a shortened sentence to be able to testify against Jason.
It all comes back to this police department.
Yeah. So he was lying. He's since recanted his testimony and that he
Yeah, because when you dangle, even if you dangle a year in front of a prisoner,
yeah,
they will come up Hell with a story yeah, that is airtight.
No offense, I would too.
Yeah.
And also, in talking about Jesse's alibi, multiple people, I know we talked about it earlier, but multiple people testified on his behalf that Jesse was out of town 40 miles away at a wrestling meet when the boys were murdered. And there's included in the witness testimony pictures of that night at the wrestling meet of them having their championship belt and all that kind of stuff.
Like,
so... The fact, and
He's
they
with
just
classmates
completely threw
and
it out.
A coach.
Yeah, they completely threw it out. Didn't give a shit. Nope. It was ridiculous.
There's no way.
So, I only have another couple things that I talked about to talk about. So, Terry Hobbs's violent behavior.
Yeah.
Terry Hobbs, who clearly by now, if you've been listening, we all know that that's who we think did it.
Yeah.
Maybe with help, maybe with friends. I don't know.
It's hard to tell, but
definitely Terry Hobbs had something to do with it.
Yeah.
So after Stevie was murdered and life had, not went on, I don't want to say that, but, they had gotten back to their normal life with, having to go to work and all that stuff. He beat the shit out of Pam.
Yep.
When Pam called her dad and her brother, and when her brother came there, he confronted Terry about beating up Pam. Terry shot him in the stomach.
Yes.
He was okay, the brother recovered, but Terry shot him in the stomach. And in a deposition, I believe in 2010, Terry Hobbs tried to sue the Dixie Chicks for defamation, because they had said about the hair in the knot, if Damien and them could be convicted without any DNA evidence, why wasn't it being looked into that Terry's hair was in the knot?
Yeah.
So he was suing the Dixie Chicks for defamation, which he had never been interviewed or deposed to talk under oath about the murders before. Well, this opened him up to that. And while going over the fact that he had shot his brother-in-law at the time, he laughed about it.
He did.
He did not. He laughed about it.
I know. And the interviewee lady is like, are you laughing?
Like, she's like, I'm sorry, is that funny? Like, and he's like,
oh, no.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, insane. Oh, I guess not. Like, he's offended that she is, like, not laughing with him.
Yeah, like it's just ridiculous to me.
It's the weirdest thing, because in that same thing was about him, like, beating the shit out of some old lady, too.
Yeah.
Of a neighbor?
I don't understand that. So then there's also, in West of Memphis, they talked to another neighbor of Terry Hobbs and Stevie Branch and Pam. Who was never talked to. None of the neighbors were talked to at the time of the murder. So Jamie Ballard and her mother, at around between 5:30 and 6:30 that evening, the evening that the boys went missing and that they were murdered, the boys were playing in her backyard. So she hollered to them and she told them, "You better go home. You better go home. It's getting late. Your moms are going to be pissed that you're not home." So the boys sped off on their bikes and she, you know, walked out the side gate to make sure they were going home. As she got out the side gate, she saw Terry Hobbs a few houses down calling to the boys to say, "Come on, come get, you know,
yeah, come in.
Come in to the house now. Let's, you know, you need to be home for dinner," all that kind of stuff. So
But Terry
maintains that on the day of May 5th, he did not see the boys at all.
At all.
He didn't see them when he got home from work. He didn't see them before they were missing, any of that kind of stuff.
Nothing.
He maintains that after he dropped Pam off at work, he went to go look for the boys, but that he had never seen them again. So the reason that Jamie had never told anybody was because A, she wasn't interviewed by the police.
No one came to her door.
And B, she assumed, as anybody would, that Terry would have told them that the last time he saw them was around 6:30.
5:30 or 6, yeah.
Yeah. So when he was calling for them to go come home for dinner. So, and then Terry's alibi is, that he dropped Pam off at work, went to his friend David Jacoby's house, with his daughter Amanda, and then they went out looking for the boys.
Yeah.
David Jacoby, when interviewed for the West of Memphis documentary, maintains that there is a 2 to 3 hour gap of time where Terry had come, left Amanda there, and then left.
Yep.
And then come back, and then they went out to go look for the boys.
Yeah.
So there is a 2 hour period, you know, 2 to 3 hour period where Terry is unaccounted for around the time of the murders.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into a little bit of a conspiracy and then we'll get to our opinions about the stuff. I know I said that earlier, but, you know. So the website that I was talking about earlier is called the West Memphis Puzzle.blog. And it's a very, very thorough look into how Terry and David Jacoby and whoever else. Oh, I'm sorry. It's LG Hollingsworth. LG Hollingsworth, Terry Hobbs, David Jacoby, and one other person, Buddy something. I wish I had it right in front of me, but it's a really long fucking website. So it's called the West Memphis Puzzle.blog. I highly recommend reading it. It's crazy. So one of the things that is Buddy Lucas is the other guy.
Oh, okay.
So this guy's theory, or women, I don't actually know, is that Aaron had said about they used to spy on these people in the woods that would go and they would do stuff. You know, engage in homosexual acts in the woods. So he believes that that was LG Hollingsworth, Buddy Lucas, Terry Hobbs, and David Jacoby that went out into the woods.
Yeah.
He's the one who said that when Aaron says in his interview about them wearing flannel and that kind of stuff, that he points out that that's what Terry is wearing when the boys' bodies are found.
Yeah.
So he also says on the website to go along with Jamie Ballard's testimony that she had seen Terry calling Stevie home for dinner. So that night, before Pam left for work at 4:30, she had made, I believe it was chicken, potatoes, and green beans. Well, in Stevie's stomach, to go along with Jamie Ballard seeing Terry calling them home, in Stevie's stomach, there was partially digested green vegetable.
Yeah.
Which would indicate that he had had something to eat. Partially digested means that he had to have eaten it only a couple of hours before he died.
Yeah.
So, the theory of this website is that Stevie went home, had dinner with Terry, then went back out with Michael and Christopher. Because Christopher had come home, John Mark Byers had said that Christopher had come home while he was out dropping his other son off somewhere and couldn't get in the house, so Christopher left again.
Yeah.
So it would, you know, probably around the time that Stevie's finishing dinner, so they go out. It was around May, so it wouldn't have gotten dark till about 8. So, it, you know, Terry told him, you know, Terry could have told Stevie, go out, but you have to be home before dark, and you need to be definitely home before your mom comes home.
Yeah.
Which would indicate why he had green vegetables in his stomach, because she had made the chicken and the green beans.
Yeah.
So then, when this indicates that David Jacoby is lying, but so it's a little iffy, but he says that at that point, Terry and David Jacoby met up with LG and Buddy and went to the woods like they typically did, that the Aaron had said that they did. And that was when they had taken Stevie to look and show him what goes on in the woods. And that,
yeah,
Terry fed, they found them and, you know, that kind of stuff. So
yeah.
I recommend reading the blog, but it definitely, it shows that how three little boys could have been subdued without one of them running off or,
yeah. Because
literally to be able to run through the woods to either the Blue Beacon car wash or to the apartment complex, they would have had to run for not very long.
No.
It wouldn't have been like running through the woods like in a horror movie where you have to run a mile before you see anybody. That's not the case at all. So it would have been very easy for one of them to get away. Well, then that, you know, leads itself to being that it's multiple people.
Well, that's the thing is, I mean, one person is not going to be able to control three scrambling boys.
No.
You can't. Three scrambling people. It doesn't matter. Like, one person like, trying to control that is hard.
The only way that I think, personally, three boys could be subdued... It also needs
to be someone they trust.
...could be that it's an authority figure in the boys' lives...
That they know.
...that they stop and they're like, oh, shit, okay.
This is serious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To stop them in their tracks, to stop them from running. Because there's no reason to listen
to a stranger.
Because why would... And, like, Stevie's not going to run away from his stepdad.
Well, like, that's the thing, you know, is, like it, even if he's doing something weird that the boys don't understand, and they see them, and he goes, hey, get back over here.
Exactly.
He's going to turn back around because and come
he's either going to have to face it then, or he's going to have to face it at home later.
So, but if it's four men that these three boys don't know...
They're running.
And they go, hey, get back over here.
They're gone.
Who the fuck are you?
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to run home. I'm going to tell my mom what I saw.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, whatever. Like, I will endure the wrath of, what are you doing out in the woods?
Yeah, exactly.
Even though the kids were out in the woods. Like, they were known. Or so even they if probably they ran knew away and
didn't tell anybody what they saw in the woods, they're still going to run away.
So there had to be at least one person that they knew there that could go, hey, get back over here. And stopped all three of them in their tracks and kept them calm enough to get their hands on them.
Exactly.
Because one of those boys was getting away.
Yeah.
If it was someone you didn't know or only one person, one of them is kicking and scrambling to get away. There's no way that you are telling two boys to sit there and wait while you hogtie one.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not going to happen.
But yeah, so I personally believe that Terry Hobbs...
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, like, it's definitely worth a read. It's long. I actually didn't finish it completely, because I was working on other notes as well, and I didn't want to overload myself, but there's two...
But you know that there's
the
something...
The lack of evidence against the three, Damien, Jason, and Jesse...
Yeah, that's not even...
...is completely eclipsed by the amount of evidence against... Terry. And I believe I didn't write it down, so don't quote me on it, but I believe that they found a handprint at the scene.
Uh-huh.
And which was David Jacoby's, and like I said before, a DNA sample of hair from David Jacoby was found at the scene.
Yeah.
And, like, technically, I guess you could say that because he was helping Terry look and they were looking in Robin Hood Hills because they knew that that's where the boys used to hang out.
Yeah.
That's why it was there, but it just seems, you know.
I just feel like Terry came up with an excuse for them.
Yeah.
Because even when they come back in West of Memphis, he breaks down.
David Jacoby, yeah.
He breaks down. And, like, there is something inside that man.
Mm-hmm.
Guilt of what he either saw, he knew, something. Like, if you can make a grown man cry like that, yeah. And a grown redneck. Like, this just isn't, like, some man that... This is a guy that has lived in this town forever. He... Redneck.
Yeah.
Good old boy, as a lot would say.
Well, and it's, you know, 20-something years of holding it in.
He breaks down.
Even if the only thing that David Jacoby never told anybody was that there was that two-hour gap where Terry was not with him, even though Terry had said he was, like, he's been holding on to that guilt, knowing that his friend, like, you know your friends more than the police are going to know your friends, so the fact that he kept that a secret meant that he knew that timeline was a big deal.
Well, and that's what he says in the documentary, is, like, once everything came out and he realized that there was that two-hour mm-hmm. gap, even if that's the pressure, like, if that's what makes him cry, then he does know his friend, like you said.
Exactly. And he knows that 2-hour period was more than enough time for Terry to go and do what he did, and that's what happened to the boys.
Because there's, you know, if you were here... And then you left for a couple hours, and then it was like, well, we're kind of, like, thinking that she did this thing. Be like, no. Nope. There is absolutely no possible way that she did this thing. Like, I know her.
Yeah. If she says she was out getting gas, she was out getting
then
gas.
Then she was.
Yeah.
For him to do that,
mm-hmm.
in his mind, he knows his friend is capable or willing to do that.
Because he kept it a secret that the 2-hour period, because Terry had always maintained that they were together the entire time. And David Jacoby was willing to keep that a secret for his friend.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And the fact that Terry is so violent.
Oh, and just, like, smug about it.
Yeah, like, you shoot your brother-in-law in the stomach and you laugh about it later. Like, there's no guilt whatsoever. And why the fuck, like... I just...
Well, and, like, I mean, it's a documentary. They always kind of... It's... The one dad is worth watching, no matter what.
John Mark Byers.
He's amazing, if I might say so myself. He is showboating. It's insane.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, he is just one of those people. He is fucking weird.
Well, and him and Pam at the time were doing drugs and and drinking a lot.
I have to say that he is a big enough man that as the documentaries come out,
mm-hmm.
he does forgive Damien. He forgives everyone that he blamed because of the evidence that is brought forward. He does believe that it was Terry.
Yeah.
Guy's a trip. Like, trust me, this guy's a trip.
One thing that is another thing that they do in the documentary and, you know, other documentaries too about they also kind of make it seem like Terry Hobbs and John Mark Byers are, like, good friends. But John Mark Byers said that he had only met Terry one time before they started searching for their kids.
Yeah.
It wasn't like they were friends and they hung out because their kids were friends. Like, they didn't know each other. Honestly, more than
the only original
Stevie's
friends
dad.
Here are the three little boys that were murdered.
Yeah.
Like, those are the original three friends.
Damien and Jason.
Yeah.
They had been best friends for a long time.
But it just... It's insane. And, like, that's why I think it's, like, once you watch the documentary, watch it again, and you just really pick up, just from the way people act, watching Terry from start to finish.
Yeah.
He doesn't care.
No.
This isn't, like, my wife's dog went missing kind of thing. Like, not only was it your stepson... It was two other boys. And, like, at the end of the day, if you are anything of a parent, a step-parent, a parent, you lived in this household with this child. He's passed away and two other boys.
Yeah. In a horrific way.
In, like, yeah, not a they all got hit by a car kind of way.
Yeah.
a horrible way that was totally unnecessary. I'm telling you, this motherfucker doesn't bat an eye.
Well, and
he doesn't do anything.
Now, Pam Hicks, which is Stevie's mom, and John Mark Byers, Christopher's adopted father, they both believe that all three, Damian, Jason, and Jesse, are innocent.
Yeah.
Pam believes that it was Terry, so yeah. does John Mark Byers. And to the point where Pam and Jason Baldwin, they have dinner.
Yeah.
They hang out. They, like, they work together on different things, like The Devil's Knot, which is an excellent movie, and there's a book about it, too, the book that inspired the movie. Like, they work together on that. Like, they see each other. They have dinner together with his, with Jason's wife. Like, well, she now says that she knows that they're innocent. And this is somebody whose 8-year-old boy was horrifically murdered.
And so a town pinned on this man.
Yeah, so she knows that, I feel, has a huge impact in the fact that if she can step back and think to herself, okay, she wants justice for her son. If the people in jail are not those people who did it, she wants the other person who actually did it to go to jail.
Well, and if anybody is looking at evidence and looking up new evidence and asking questions, it's going to be the mom.
Yeah.
If her mom instinct is saying, no, not this guy, you got to go with that. Yeah. Like, you do. Like, you don't spend time with someone where you go, maybe.
Well, and you also don't bring up the fact that your sister saw him, your husband doing laundry, curtains and stuff from your son's, murdered son's room. You don't bring up the pocket knife. You kind of just, like.
And it's also knowing Terry
if you truly believe that the three men that are in jail are guilty, a fucking pocket knife in a nightstand doesn't matter. Well, the excuse of it being because an 8-year-old boy shouldn't have a pocket knife would be completely enough for you to be like, yeah, you know what, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, not to maintain completely that Stevie, in her, you know, in her mind and her heart, she knows for a fact that Stevie would have had the knife with him, and also thought to herself when she got his personal effects back that since the knife wasn't in there, the murderer must have the knife.
Yeah. Well, and it's when Terry is in the courtroom while these three men are on trial, he's the happiest I've ever seen a person.
Yeah.
And
well, like I said earlier, he laughs.
It is so blatant that this guy is looking at these three men and he's going, this town is in such a ruckus about this shit.
Yeah, I'm never going to have to be worried about it.
They are never even going to sniff me a little. Mother's crying. Stepdad's just, they look enraged. They want to kill these three men. And Terry's like elbowing them and like, isn't this just the best time?
Michael Moore, one thing that is in the documentaries that really kind of bothers me, obviously a lot of about it bothers me, but one thing that's really like icky is that they had like, I don't know, I'm guessing it was probably like devised by the documentary crew. Kind of like you'll see in the documentaries that John Mark Byers goes to where the boys were murdered and burns shit and stuff, which he said later was
so
part of the documentary. Yeah. And that the documentary had kind of like, hey, why don't you go do this kind of thing?
Yeah. This guy was fucking crazy. So they were like, here's a lighter and some leaves. What do you want to do?
Yeah. Like, so like Michael Moore's dad, Terry Hobbs and John Mark Byers, they go to like out in the field and they go shooting and they all talk about how like, oh, this bullet's for you, Damien. This bullet's for you, Jason. That black hole in that pumpkin there is for you, Damien. I'm going to shoot it. Like, they all talk about, like, wanting to murder these kids because they murdered their kids, which, like, I get it. Like, just, I get it.
It's
but,
bad
like,
taste.
It's almost, like, gleeful. Like, yeah. I would never presume to, like, try to, you know, figure out how a grieving parent feels. But the way these people are, especially, I know that there was some speculation that John Mark Byers had been part of the murders.
Yeah.
Because there was the point where he had given a pocket knife to the documentary crew, and they had noticed that there was blood on the knife, and when the blood was typed, because, like I said, you couldn't do DNA back then. The blood was typed. It came back as a match to Christopher Byers, but also John Mark Byers, because they both had the same blood type.
Yeah.
But there was no DNA back then, so they couldn't tell you specifically whether it was John Mark Byers or whether it was Christopher Byers. And there was other things like the bite marks, quote-unquote, on the boys' bodies. John Mark Byers, his teeth had all been pulled very quickly after the murder. Yeah. So it was just all different kinds of things. But, like, it, like, they seem, the dads in that specific scene with the guns, especially Michael Moore's dad as well, almost seem gleeful that they are doing this thing with the guns. Because it's almost like, hey, if we act this way, people will never suspect that we had anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Same way with, obviously, Terry Hobbs. But, like, Michael Moore's parents always were a little weird to me.
Yeah.
Like, Pam obviously was devastated. John Mark Byers and his wife were
weird.
Like, she
in a
was,
different way.
Yeah.
She also
she passed away from, like, a drug overdose, but didn't have, like, the drugs in her system. It was weird.
It was weird.
But one thing that she says is that I found so weird, Christopher Byers' mom, she says in the documentary, if God was going to take my son, why didn't he take him when he was a baby? Why did he let me have 8 years with him and then take him away?
Yeah.
What parent would think that way? I know, like, with your mom.
Yeah.
We talked about this last night.
Yeah.
It's never been, like, I got into a horrific car accident when I was 16. I had passed away.
Your mom my wouldn't mom trade never, those 16 years
exactly.
for you to be a
she
babe.
She would have been like, she would never think to herself, I wish that I had just died as a baby so that she didn't have 16 years worth of memories and everything.
Yeah.
She would cherish those memories that she had of me. So that just always seems suspect to me that she thought that way.
I guess it just depends on how you feel in that situation. I guess maybe she... And again, it's not like they delve into, like, how she feels or how she thinks, but this is also something we were talking about the other day. She might have went through postpartum depression really bad, and during that time had that, like, this baby, this is horrible, this is... There might have been a time in her life before that baby had the personality that her boy did and gave her the happiness that he did.
It's such a weird
thing.
It is
very weird. I guess it's one of those things where it's like, if someone gives you this doll, and you're like, cool, doll, but then takes it away, you're like, okay, it's gone now.
Yeah.
But if someone gives you this doll, and you name it, you buy different clothes for it.
Yeah.
You play with it, it sleeps in your bed every night, and 8 years later, they go, give me that doll back. And then they leave, they're just gone. They get in a car, and they leave, and you don't know who they were. You go, but me and my doll have so much history now that I can kind of see where she's thinking, like, before this baby became this thing
with a personality,
and it talked, and it loved me, and...
Yeah, I guess my thing with it is...
It is weird.
That's the kind of thought that you have to yourself, and then kind of shake it off, like, wow, don't think about that.
I guess saying it out loud to, like, the
world. Instead of saying it out loud to the world, it just seems like a really weird thing to say. And I don't think she had anything to do with it, don't get me wrong, that's not what I'm saying.
No.
But these parents, they acted very...
Those two are really dramatic.
Yeah.
That sounds like something you would almost put on Facebook so people, like, write you and say, like, no, don't say that.
Yeah.
It seems, now I'm not saying, because she was pretty quiet during the documentary, I'm not saying that she was looking for attention, but it might, if you haven't seen it, this guy is, like, over the top. Like, he's crazy. So, if she's caught up with him, because how he is just, like, a whole circus in one person.
Mm-hmm.
If she's caught up in that moment, it is something very dramatic. Very dramatic to say.
Yeah.
That kind of coattails the way he acts.
Yeah.
So, I get it, but I always found it really weird, too. Because it was just kind of like...
Like, wow, okay.
Don't you'd want the baby or the 8-year-old.
Yeah, like wouldn't you rather have had the 8 years that you had instead of none?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, it's just weird. But, it's been an hour and a half, so we're probably going to wrap this up. But let us know your theories. We'd love to hear them. Like I said, check out that website. It's a very convincing theory. And it goes along the same vein as us believing that Terry Hobbs definitely had something to do with it.
And this is, like Sam said earlier, this is one of our favorite cases because it was us.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have any criminal charges. You know, we talk tough shit, but we were chicken.
Yeah.
We were that, if we were in a small town the way that we are, that people knew us enough, you know, the makeup we did in high school, the clothes we wore in high school, just us being, end of the day, moody teenagers.
Yeah.
I still have notebooks from high school that have all kinds of shit written on it. Yeah. And I look at it now,
and I'm like, pentagrams and upside down crosses.
I still have them.
Yeah.
It just, we would be indicted. Yeah. Instantly. Mm-hmm. Instantly, we could be the scapegoat. And I know that a lot of you can look back on your past and go, wow, if a town of honkies saw me,
yeah,
I would be the scapegoat.
Yeah.
That's,
it's the same as, like, the Salem witch trials. We would have been, you know,
the scapegoat.
Exactly.
It's, that's why it's always resonated with us watching these documentaries, because it's, looking at him, he's us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so easy for us to put ourselves in his shoes, where one thing you write down on paper, or one thing you circle in a book because you're all moody and, my God, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard.
Gets you on death row.
Puts you on death row. Yeah. Because he has a pentagram drawn in a book, or I've got the book of, I've got Anton LaVey's book.
Mm-hmm. When I have spell books and Wiccan books, and, like, they're on my shelf right now, like.
And you're gonna, it's death row.
Yeah.
Because a group of people that don't understand and can't step outside a circle and go, he's a moody freaking teenager.
Yeah. Like, the worst thing he did was run away with his girlfriend.
It ruined, it ruined a majority of his life.
Yeah.
It ruined the best years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
What should have been. Regardless of what town you're in or what you believe in or anything, it is the best years of your life. That's your young life.
Mm-hmm.
And he just went from teenager to middle-aged.
Yeah.
And it's horrible. But it's very, very interesting. And it's sad that the three boys completely lost their voice. The three murdered boys, there was no one there for them.
No, and they still don't have justice.
No.
Because there is, you know, regardless of what you believe, there's no evidence whatsoever to indicate that the three men that were convicted are the murderers.
And because,
so that means that either they've passed away by now, or they are still out there. And, you know,
because of what the state finally did with Damien and them.
Yeah, they won't ever.
It's done.
It won't ever be. They won't ever admit that they need to reopen the case.
No.
So, and what's more, like, one of the most frustrating things is that because it's not that old of a case.
It's not.
Like, it's, you know, it's almost 30 years old. That's like, it's still 27 years old.
Yeah.
But there's enough people around. There's enough witnesses. There's parents. There's everybody still alive. There's people
that lived in it.
Yeah. Like, that can still help solve this case and get justice for the three boys. And I just think that,
if you can have new evidence against, like, the Zodiac killer, and you can have new evidence in the Black Dahlia, this should deserve its new evidence.
Yeah.
But the state found their scapegoats.
Yeah. So, and they don't want to pay.
They want to wash their hands of three boys that lost their lives.
Yeah.
And numerous families that lost theirs too.
Yeah. But check out this weekend, Saturday and Sunday,
the
Forgotten West Memphis 3 on Oxygen Network. It's hosted by Bob Ruff. I highly, highly recommend his podcast as well. All seasons, but season 5 specifically is the West Memphis case. And
what's his podcast called?
Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff.
Truth and Justice.
Mm-hmm. But we hope you enjoyed this dive into the true crime. If you enjoyed this and you want us to do other cases, we're more than willing to talk about different true crime cases.
We love it.
But we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.